From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson.
Here we are at Piocho Ranch, which is the intersection of a couple of our family's passions. Polo on the one hand and wine on the other.
This is Tom Barrick in a promotional video for his winery outside of Santa Barbara, California.
And oftentimes people say, well, what is the connection between polo and wine? And there are several, but the most important one is stewardship.
The winery is Barrick's side business. His real money comes from real estate. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about him this hour, in part because he's one of Donald Trump's oldest and closest friends. In all the ways that Trump is the quintessential New York billionaire, Barrick is all that for L.A. He pals around with Hollywood stars and champion surfers. Where Trump drinks Diet Coke, Barrick takes pride in his family's fine wine. Barrick's Bordeaux was served at Trump's inauguration. In fact, Barrick planned the whole inauguration. He raised more than $100 million for it. Here he is at the Lincoln Memorial the night before Trump took the oath of office.
Welcome the 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump.
In the video, you can see Trump putting his hand on Barrick's shoulder. They're really close.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. And thank you, Tom.
Reveal's Aaron Glantz has been looking into Barrick. He joins me now. So, Aaron, how did these two guys actually meet?
They met back in the 1980s. Tom Barrick was working for this Texas developer, and he helped Donald Trump buy the Plaza Hotel in New York. And remember back when Donald Trump being president seemed totally absurd to most people, and nobody in the Republican Party would give him the time of day, and nobody would endorse him? Tom Barrick endorsed him, and he started raising money for him, and he raised $22 million for one of Trump's super PACs. And now that Donald Trump is president, they have lunch together at the White House. Barrick told CNN they talk every day. And the New York Times says he's one of the few people that Donald Trump trusts.
So it sounds like they're pretty tight, but how did Barrick get rich in the first place?
Barrick is one of these investors who makes a lot of money profiting off of other people's pain. He made his first big pile of money off of the savings and loan crisis. He profited off the dot-com bust. And when the Great Recession happened, he was there to make one of his biggest plays yet.
Yeah, and this time he's making money off of the housing bust. So we're going to spend the hour on housing, really on home ownership. Last year, it hit its lowest level in 50 years. While regular people have been struggling to keep their homes or save enough to buy one, Barrick has just been winning and winning.
Let me take you back to 2005. That year, Fortune magazine called Tom Barrick the world's greatest real estate investor. On the cover, he's smiling, an image of a gold house reflected in his aviator sunglasses. It was the height of the housing boom, but Tom Barrick told Fortune there was a bubble. He saw the crash coming, and he started cashing out on many of his real estate investments. His close friend Donald Trump said he'd welcome the crash.
Well, first of all, I sort of hope that happens, because then people like me would go in and buy.
That was recorded at a Trump University seminar in 2006.
If there is a bubble burst, as they call it, you can make a lot of money. You know, if you're in a good cash position, which I'm in a good cash position today, then people like me would go in and buy like crazy.
That's exactly what Barrick did. After the bubble burst, he founded a company that began buying thousands of foreclosed homes all over the country. Like this one on West 69th Street in South Los Angeles. It's a small Southern California bungalow with white aluminum siding behind a short metal gate. Marcus Butler grew up in this house.
Back in the back, my father had a little garden area where he grew, like, tomatoes, stuff like that. Tomatoes, greens, stuff like that. And he would pick it from back there and eat it.
Today, the yard is overgrown with crabgrass.
I mean, it's not been kept up too good, but basically still the same.
Marcus's parents bought the house in 1963. After they, like millions of other African Americans, left the Jim Crow South. And by the 1990s, the house was all paid off. But Marcus's father died, and his mom developed dementia, and she gambled. In 2007, she took out a giant $544,000 reverse mortgage. That's when the bank pays you for the equity in your house. A lot of retired people do it to supplement their income. But it's really a loan.
I mean, they put all this money in your face. You know, the only thing you see is the money, but you're not really listening to what they're explaining to you.
The loan Marcus's mother got came with an interest rate that topped out at 17%. And when she died in 2012, the family lost the home to foreclosure.
Me personally, I would have wanted to pass the house on. I mean, you know, it sounds like if I passed on, I would have passed it on to my son or my daughter. I mean, that's what, you know, we were taught when we were younger. Try to keep the house in the family.
The bank that foreclosed, it was run by Steve Mnuchin. You may recognize the name. He's now Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. Documents from HUD show Mnuchin's bank was responsible for nearly 40% of all reverse mortgage foreclosures that came after the housing bust. After Mnuchin's bank took the house, it sat empty for almost a year before it sold at auction for $180,000. Tom Barrack's company was the buyer. The firm would end up owning more than 30,000 single-family homes across 10 states.
This is my investment philosophy.
Barrack laid out his vision in a speech to real estate investors at a University of Chicago conference during the depths of the Great Recession.
You man up or woman up, and you walk into a jungle where no one else wants to be, and you swing and you fight and you bite, and eventually, if you're successful, they're all swinging with you, and then you've got to move to another jungle.
Barrack became king of the jungle of American foreclosures, and his company became a big-time landlord by turning all those homes into rentals. Barrack even bragged about how cheap it was.
We retrofit many of these houses for $1,500 total.
Managing them was easy, he said, even with the homes spread out all over the country.
How can you manage them when they're everywhere? Well, how do you manage Wendy's? How do you manage McDonald's? How do you manage FedEx? How do you manage Kinko's?
Until the crash, this kind of company simply didn't exist. Of course, there have always been landlords on single-family homes, but they were mostly mom-and-pop landlords. And this kind of thing, where one company owned and rented out thousands of single-family homes in cities all over the country, from Los Angeles to Miami, it had never been done before. Four months after Barrack's company bought Marcus's family home at auction, a guy named Sean Pruitt signed a lease for the bungalow and moved in.
Hey there.
Hey, Sean, how's it going?
I'll be
okay?
Okay. Sean comes to the door, a wisp of a man with limbs barely thicker than sticks. It's the middle of the day. He's wearing a T-shirt and boxer shorts. Sean lives here with his partner and five dogs. He tells me he used to own his own house, too. A small farm in Texas.
I had two donkeys, four hens, three goats, five dogs, and we were going to get into beekeeping, but that never happened.
Because Sean got sick. He has AIDS and lymphoma. He sold his farm and moved to L.A. to be closer to the UCLA Medical Center. That's how he ended up as a tenant with Barrack's company as his landlord.
And then they called this a bedroom, this tiny little hole of a room.
Looking around the house, it doesn't seem like Barrack's company has done any work.
And do you use this as
the carpet's frayed. The kitchen linoleum is peeling. Outside, fronds from a neighboring palm tree are tangled in the electrical wire. Sean's lease makes fixing that his responsibility. And he says he can't afford it. Sean pays about $1,800 a month in rent. It's gone up every year since he moved in.
You'd think you'd be praised and rewarded for paying your rent on time and not having any problems and all that. But instead, they raise your rent and punish you, basically, for being a good tenant.
He'd like to move, but doesn't have the money. Meantime, his pantry is stocked with Campbell's soup and Jiffy peanut butter, donated from the local food bank. After four rounds of chemo, Sean's doctors have told him he probably only has a few months left.
I'm beyond helping at this point. I'm just kind of, they sent me on my way to basically die. So that's what I'm doing now, and we're sitting here and you're watching me die. I know that sounds so macabre, but it's true.
And Sean is expecting another rent increase when his lease runs out in August. He might not live that long.
Sean is just one of tens of thousands of people across the country renting homes from the company Barrick founded. And while Barrick says it's no big deal to manage properties across state lines, not everyone agrees.
They are kind of the ultimate absentee, far removed, out-of-state landlord.
When we come back, we head to Georgia, where the company owns 6,000 homes and is raising billions of dollars off of them on Wall Street. You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hi, I'm Will Carlos, a correspondent covering extremism in America for Reveal. Every week, I choose a topic that has caught my attention and put together The Hate Report, a short bulletin we send out on Friday mornings. I might take an in-depth look at a breaking news story, like a racist hate crime such as the recent stabbings in Portland. Or I'll put together an analysis of a topic of interest in the world of hate in today's America. You can sign up on our website to have The Hate Report sent to your inbox each week. Just go to revealnews.org/hate.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson.
Please welcome the founder and executive chairman of Colony Capital, Tom Barrack.
Real estate mogul Tom Barrack is one of Donald Trump's oldest and closest friends. He introduced Ivanka at the Republican National Convention.
Wow, this is a wow. But I have to tell you, I feel like the anchovy on Ivanka's Caesar salad. I know you're salivating for that and you're going to get it.
Okay, whatever that means. Clearly, he is much better at real estate than he is at introducing people. So, after the housing crash, Barrack scooped up tens of thousands of single-family homes and turned them into rentals. More than 30,000 of them are controlled by a single company. Reveal's Aaron Glantz has been investigating. Hey, Aaron.
Hi, Al.
So, what can you tell me about how Barrack operates?
He founded a company that's now called Colony Starwood Homes. Tenants know it as Waypoint. That's where they send their rent checks. But collecting rent is only one of the ways Barrack makes money. I have three words for you. Mortgage-backed securities.
Yes, I remember that term. Mortgage-backed securities. A complicated financial product that helped tank the economy in 2008, right?
Yeah, that's when banks were bundling all these home mortgages together, and they were creating these financial products that were filled with crap. And then after the crash, Tom Barrack, he was one of the people who got in on the ground floor in creating a whole new type of mortgage-backed security, one that was based on all the rental homes his company owned. You remember that bungalow in Los Angeles that we were talking about earlier? Less than a year after Barrack's company bought it, it was bundled along with more than 3,000 other homes into this giant mortgage-backed security. $514 million funded by J.P. Morgan Chase. To understand how that works, you have to go 3,000 miles away from that Los Angeles bungalow to Wall Street.
Floor 48, doors open.
Up on the 48th floor of the World Trade Center in New York, Brian Allen is examining Barrack's financial creation. As a vice president at Morningstar Credit Ratings, Brian's job is to make sure the homes are worth what Colony says they are, and that the rents tenants pay will be enough to make money for investors.
One of the indicators is if there's a tenant in the property. If the property is rentable, we can make some assumption that it is in a habitable form and in good working condition.
Brian's only seen pictures of the homes in Colony's mortgage-backed securities. That's because he uses what critics call drive-by appraisals. To estimate the value of each of the homes in the bundle, Brian relies on an outside company that hires real estate brokers instead of appraisers. Another Brian, Brian Groh, is a managing director at Morningstar. He feels good about the process.
There were pictures for every property, and so we felt the process was diligent.
But if this sounds fishy to you, you're not alone. Earlier this year, the SEC began investigating the company Colony hired to value the homes. It's part of a wider look into these new mortgage-backed securities. It's a sensitive topic because artificially inflated home prices helped cause the housing bust and the Great Recession. But Brian Groh says, don't worry. There's a whole system of checks that will prevent that from happening again.
If it turns out that a broker is getting the value wrong, then they'll ding that broker on the scorecard. We felt there's an incentive for the brokers to provide accurate valuations.
And it's not just how much the houses are worth. Morningstar also looks at how fast the rent is going up in each of these homes. The more the rent goes up, the better for investors. And the investors are happy. Today, Barrick's company has created six of these mortgage-backed securities. Colony essentially took out a huge loan against the value of tens of thousands of its homes, worth $3.2 billion, all with JP Morgan Chase. Barrick and his investors get that $3.2 billion right now. And all those Colony tenants, they're the ones paying back that debt, little by little, every month, to JP Morgan Chase. So how are all those tenants faring? Colony owns thousands of homes in Tampa, Miami, and Southern California. Houston, Dallas, Denver, Orlando, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. I went to their biggest market, Atlanta, Georgia, where the company owns 6,000 homes. I went door to door visiting dozens of Colony properties. Most of the homes are in the suburbs, on tree-lined streets in neighborhoods with good schools. But inside, many of them are falling apart.
Hi there.
Hi.
Tenants told me about peeling tile, collapsing counters, and even a snake infestation. At one house, a young mother named Makita Edwards came to the door. She told me about what happened when her baby was just 3 months old, right after her family moved in.
Me and my baby was on our bed, and our ceiling fan just fell through.
And like from the ceiling of your, like mm-hmm. the big unit, like a light fixture?
Mm-hmm. Just fell, and it fell on the bed where we were.
Nobody got hurt, but the house has been a disaster ever since they moved in 6 months ago. So you had no heat, your ceiling collapsed, mm-hmm. your sink leaked, your refrigerator leaked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the same time you're going through all of this, you're getting a stream of eviction notices?
With my mom, yep.
Makita's mom lives here too. When they first moved in, things were hectic. They were late paying rent. Within weeks, they got an eviction notice. Colony demanded the past due rent, $1,580, and on top of that, late fees, court filing costs, the fee for Colony's lawyer, and another fee to pay the person who served them the eviction notice. With all those fees, they couldn't catch up. And it became a cycle of late fees, court costs, and more eviction notices, one each of the first 6 months they lived here. They ended up paying about $200 extra each month, on top of their rent. I told Makita that Colony, her landlord, was founded by Tom Barrack, one of Donald Trump's oldest and closest friends.
He's at the top. He's a big guy. We're just little people in his world. So, what can you say?
Colony's corporate filings with the SEC show that last year it made $26 million on fees and tenant clawbacks. That's when they take money away from tenants, like keeping their security deposits. Last year, researchers at the Federal Reserve found that in Fulton County, in the heart of Atlanta, corporate landlords were much more likely than mom-and-pop landlords to file eviction notices. Colony was the most aggressive. In a single year, the company moved to evict a third of its tenants. But they won't rent to tenants who have ever been evicted. So Colony essentially takes good tenants and in a lot of cases turns them into bad ones.
All rise.
I spent several days going to eviction court in Atlanta. It's called dispossessory court here.
Jonathan Moore.
The gallery is full of worried faces, almost all of them black. People who have taken time off work to try to save their home. Michael Lucas is deputy director of the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation. He helped write that report by the Federal Reserve. Lucas says you just have to look at the courtroom to see that in Atlanta, tenants don't have many legal rights.
In a usual courtroom, or if you watch law shows on TV, you know, one side is for the plaintiff and one side is for the defendant, and you have some measure of balance there. And in the Fulton County Dispossessory Court, all three desks are taken up by the landlord's attorneys, and it's very clear who they are, and it is kind of, they have kind of such a presence that you get a sense they're running the show.
Tenants almost always lose because the law in Georgia gives almost all the rights to the landlord. So the judges usually begin court by making a short speech, urging tenants to go out into the hallway to try to negotiate an agreement with the landlord's attorneys. It's their last chance to avoid being thrown out on the street. One day, out in the hallway, I meet up with Yvette Frazier. She's clutching an eviction notice and trying desperately to reach her son, Ronnie, who's out of town.
Frazier, is there any kind of way you can text me, we man, new number or something? Because I still don't have it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm finished. I'll send it to you.
All right. Nervous cough.
Ronnie's a staff sergeant in the Air Force. He'd been deployed out of state, and it's his name that's on the lease.
So I'm doing all I can to get in touch with him so I can get this taken care of. He has a nice home. He's only 25. This is his first rental property ever. He ever rented anything in his life. That's him right there.
The judge says that because Yvette's name isn't on the lease, he would be legally obligated to order them out right away unless she works something out with Colony's lawyer, Raina Lynn Holmes. The two of them sit on a bench outside the courtroom door.
I may be able to talk to him. So what is it that y'all want to do?
No, I'm staying.
You want to pay the money and stay? Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I can't make an arrangement with you because you're not the tenant. But what I can do, since the landlord is willing to let you pay and stay, when we go in front of the judge, he's going to, it'll be drafted as a motion, meaning that it's a motion to strike saying that the defendant did not appear, but will give you the 7 days to work out a pay and stay since he's in the military.
Yeah.
Okay.
When the lawyer says Yvette can pay and stay, it sounds like she's trying to help. But Yvette could get a much better deal. Under federal law, Colony had to tell the judge her son is in the military. And the judge has the power to stay the eviction for up to 3 months. But since Yvette doesn't know this and doesn't have a lawyer, she doesn't ask for it. She agrees to take the first deal Colony's lawyer offers and promises to pay back rent within 7 days, along with more than $400 in fees. If she doesn't come up with the money, Colony can get the marshals to throw Yvette and her son out.
They are kind of the ultimate absentee, far removed, out-of-state landlord that, generally speaking, we see is quicker to evict. We see that on the ground level.
Again, lawyer Michael Lucas, who helped write that Federal Reserve study on evictions in Atlanta.
It would actually be in the landlord's interest to wait until the middle of the month or the end of the month, and they'll get that rent, and they won't have to go through the costs on a landlord of displacement. Instead, they are a massive bureaucracy, not unlike kind of the servicers of all the mortgages when that went bad. And they're just making a decision. On the 5th, we evict, or whatever it is.
Colony disputes the report about its high eviction rate. They say the Federal Reserve looked at only a small portion of the homes they own. And even there, Colony says they actually ended up kicking out just 10% of their tenants. The company wouldn't agree to an interview, but gave us a statement. It said they pride themselves on being, quote, a responsible landlord that provides its residents with an exceptional living experience. They said the company plays a critical role in the U.S. economy by combining the benefits of homeownership with the mobility and convenience of renting. We gave Colony a list of the homes in this story, along with questions about their fees, but they didn't respond. They also didn't respond to our questions about mortgage-backed securities. And what about Tom Barrack? I spent 2 months trying to schedule an interview with him. I told his publicist I was willing to fly anywhere in the country to ask him questions about his real estate business and his relationship with Donald Trump. But Barrack's publicist said he wouldn't be interviewed, so I called his cell phone.
Hello?
Hi, Tom Barrack?
Yes.
This is Aaron Glantz from Reveal. We're a national radio program. I'm recording this conversation.
Aaron, I'll have you call my associates. I'll give them the number. I'm in Mexico in the middle of lunch.
I understand that. Right.
I started to ask him about Colony's eviction rate, but he hung up on me.
While Barrack was having lunch in Mexico, a crew was hard at work on a mansion he's building in Los Angeles. I drove up into the hills of Bel Air, just a few miles from that rundown bungalow on West 69th Street. Up here, a cement mixer is churning, and behind a chain-link fence, I got a glimpse of Tom Barrack's half-built mansion. When it's done, it'll be 77,000 square feet across 9 acres. It'll have 3 fountains, 2 swimming pools, a tennis court, and 10 bedrooms for the help. A gatehouse bigger than the bungalow. There are rumors that he's building it for a Qatari sheikh, but Barrack's name is the only one on the plans. Barrack's already cashing out of the rental housing business early, just like he did before the housing crash in 2008. He's taken his company public and has started selling off his stock. In March, he made $127 million in a single day.
That's Reveal's Aaron Glantz. Aaron, just a few quick questions for you. We talked about the fact that Barrack and Trump are such good friends. Who else should we be keeping an eye on?
Well, Barrack isn't the only guy. Trump has surrounded himself with people who made a ton of money during the housing bust. There's Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, whose bank foreclosed on so many people that he became known as the Foreclosure King. There's Steve Schwarzman, the chairman of Blackstone, whose company owns even more homes than Barrack's. He's head of a special economic advisory group that meets regularly with Trump at the White House. And the vice chairman of that group is Jamie Dimon, the president and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. They created all of Colony's mortgage-backed securities.
So it sounds like all these people have the president's ear. What kind of things are they pushing for?
It's pretty early to tell, especially because Donald Trump hasn't laid out a comprehensive plan. But within an hour of taking the oath of office, his administration took a step that made homeownership more expensive for 1 million Americans and pushed it out of reach entirely for others. It reversed an Obama rule that would have made mortgages less expensive for a lot of working class people. And another thing we do know is this. If the homeownership rate stays where it is now, at this really low level, all of these bankers and private equity guys surrounding Donald Trump stand to benefit. And all the better for them if the housing market takes a really long time to recover from the hit it took during the Great Recession.
That's Reveal's Aaron Glantz. And it turns out that just a week after we reached him in Mexico, Barrack walked away from the rental company he founded. He sold off all the rest of his stock in Colony Starwood Homes and resigned from its board of trustees. Colony built its business on a new real estate scheme. Next, we look at an old scheme that kept black families from buying homes 50 years ago. It's called a land contract. And now they're making a comeback. That's ahead on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Chicago, 1959. Ruby and Robert Lee York were looking to buy a house for themselves and their 8 children. The Yorks did buy a house, sort of. They got something called a land contract for a 2-story graystone house in a neighborhood called Lawndale. Ruby and Robert Lee have both passed on. I talked to their children, Sandra and Donald York, who both grew up in the house.
We were just like the Waltons, just about.
Thanksgiving, you know, was the whole family. We just gathered around. We sat on boxes. We sat on crates, you know, just so that everybody can get around this Thanksgiving table.
It was home, but they actually didn't own the house. Back then in Chicago and cities across America, the vast majority of banks wouldn't give mortgages to Black people.
Back then, you had to work with what you had. The deal was that you weren't allowed to have a mortgage, but you were allowed to have a contract.
The contract said that they had to put some money down and then pay monthly installments. The Yorks wouldn't get the deed until the contract was paid in full.
There was no grace period. It was like you missed that payment and that was it. And then you were out and then they sold your home again to another family.
And houses sold on contract almost always cost more than a similar house that a white family could get with a mortgage.
It was much more than that. It was almost like double the amount.
Or triple or quadruple.
And that's why it was so many people who were missing the payments because they just kept taking the payments up.
The York children watched as other families from the neighborhood who had land contracts too were evicted from their houses.
I would see people, furniture, literally out on the street with the sheriff standing right there next to them, telling them that you can't take this back in the house. They got put out because they missed one single payment.
Now, by the late 60s, some of the families had started to fight back. The Yorks joined an activist group called the Contract Buyers League. When a neighbor was evicted, they would rush over and carry all of their furniture right back inside while armed sheriff's deputies were still there. They demanded fair contracts, outright ownership of their homes that some had already paid off two or three times over.
Even as kids, we used to go with them to picket the federal building. They just kind of picketed a lot of the different buildings, City Hall. So wherever they went, my mom took us. And so little did we know the importance of what they were doing.
After years of fighting with the banks, the government, and the slumlords, more than 100 families in the Contract Buyers League were able to get mortgages and become legal homeowners. The Yorks got their deed in the early 1970s. But thousands of other families who weren't in the Contract Buyers League were evicted or never got a mortgage. After Sandra grew up, her mom told her a story that she had protected her from as a kid. When they first got the contract in 1959, there was a white family already living in the house. The contract seller hadn't bothered to ask them to move, and the York family had to live in the basement.
It was an entire year that they lived there rent-free.
So your mother and father were basically paying for these white people to live above you.
I'm sorry, Al. Give me a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
The story does this to me every time.
What does it bring up for you when you think about that?
Well, we had so much love in the house that for someone to do something to my mom and my dad like that, when they were just hardworking people who were trying to give their children opportunities, and it saddens me.
After the fight in Chicago, land contracts never went away entirely. And now, in post-housing bust America, they are back in full force.
Stop renting and start buying. $500 down, $500 a month. Good credit, bad credit, no credit. We have something for everyone. Call Detroit Property Exchange.
Ground Zero, Detroit, where companies are offering thousands of vacant foreclosed-on homes to people who can't get traditional mortgages. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio has our story.
I like living in here because our stuff is here.
Kimora Beecham is 5 years old. This white, vinyl-sided bungalow is the third place she's called home. The last two were rentals. But Kimora's mom and dad, Denise Pope and Kevin Beecham, they didn't want to rent anymore.
And that's all I wanted to do is become a homeowner and better myself for my children.
But Denise says there were problems.
I didn't have the right type of credit or the amount of money to get a home.
So they found this house with a big evergreen tree out front. It's on the fringes of a desirable neighborhood, the kind of stable neighborhood lots of Detroiters aspire to. And it was available for $18,000 on a land contract.
And all you have to do is put a substantial amount down and then pay $500 a month, which sounded pretty decent for us at the time. We just had our taxes and we were ready.
They put $3,500 down. Besides the $500 installment payments, they agreed to pay the seller $83 each month for property taxes. And they figured they'd be homeowners in just a few years. They moved in, painted the walls, put new pipes in.
Watch this, yep.
Kevin is in the process of putting in a furnace. The old one got stripped by vandals.
So I just took it out and put another one in, bought a used one at the resale shop at Habitat for Humanity.
Now he's waiting for an electrician friend of his to come by and finish hooking it up. In spite of the work it needs, he says he's thankful for this house.
We got a home, we got a roof, and just crawl before you walk. Ain't nothing new, you just gotta keep your head up, pray, put it in the Lord's hands. That's all you can do.
Everything was going along fine until last fall. That's when Denise came home to find a yellow notice on the front door. In Detroit, everybody knows what those yellow cards mean. They're a warning from the county that a house is headed to auction for unpaid property taxes. Denise and Kevin went down to the county to try to figure out what was going on. They found out the house had a back tax bill from before they ever signed a contract to buy it. Kevin says they were told the person who owned their house had already been there.
And they were denied a payment plan. So that's what really made us scared.
Scared because the county could seize the house for back taxes. Kevin and Denise say they kept paying the $500 a month toward their contract, but they started withholding their tax payments while they worked out an agreement with the seller. Then the seller served them with eviction papers.
And we about to move.
That's 5-year-old Kimora again. She and her family might not actually have to move out, not yet anyway. A judge dismissed their eviction case because it wasn't filed with the right paperwork. But Denise says the whole thing has shaken up her family.
And it had my kids thinking, oh, well, we got to move again. Oh, we're about to lose our house with my little baby. She walked right up to you and said, well, we're going to move again. You know, that's all she know right now. You know, and I'm hating that because she's only 5.
Denise says a year ago, she thought a land contract was her way into the American dream, a way to pass something of real value onto her kids that they could build on.
I've just been let down with this land contract stuff here. I just see sharks.
So let's talk about this land contract stuff here for a minute. Sarah Mancini is with the National Consumer Law Center. She's interviewed people across the country who've gotten into predatory land contract deals.
Most people that we've spoken to had no idea that the papers they signed were any different from a mortgage loan. But what they knew was they found a house and they found someone who said, we can make you the owner of this house.
The biggest problem Mancini sees is that people who get into land contracts have all the obligations of homeownership with none of the rights and protections of homeownership. They don't have a deed. They often don't get the tax breaks of a homeowner, even though they have to pay taxes and home insurance. And Mancini says if they fall behind on their payments, there's no foreclosure process.
So you could be living in a house making these payments for years, and if you had a normal mortgage, you would be building up equity in the home. But in a land contract, they have this thing called a forfeiture clause that says that if you miss a single payment, the seller has the right to forfeit the contract and keep all the money you've paid and evict you like a tenant.
Welcome to the 3rd District Court, State of Michigan, City of Detroit. The Honorable Judge Cynthia Latoya Miller presiding.
In Detroit, this is where those forfeiture cases wind up. 36th District Court is one of the nation's busiest housing courts. In 2016, 34,000 cases were filed. 34,000 cases for 4 judges. Cynthia Latoya Miller is one of them.
And I will tell you, in the 11 years I've been a judge, there's been a marked increase in these land contract cases.
So how many land contracts are there in Detroit? We analyzed 13 years of records from Wayne County, where Detroit is. In every year but one since the crash, there were more land contracts than mortgages. In some years, double the number. And there are likely many more land contracts than the records show. That's because there is no law that requires them to be recorded anywhere at all. That's true in almost every state. So across the country, in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, just to name a few, there's this whole segment of the housing market that's unregulated, and no one knows exactly how big it is. And in Detroit, Judge Miller says as land contracts have come under scrutiny, she started to see a new type of contract. They're leases with an option to purchase.
There isn't a law that says they cannot do these things that I'm aware of, and that's the problem. But ethically, they're questionable, and they do set up people for failure.
The guy who sold Denise and Kevin their house declined to be interviewed. So did two other property management companies that do a lot of business in Detroit. Both of them said there was just no upside to talking to a reporter about land contracts. But there is a real estate broker in the Detroit neighborhood where I live who was more than willing to talk to me.
Okay. We have 3, 6, 8 different boards, starting with our rentals and commercials, rentals and residential, land contract commercials.
Robert Labute is a tall guy with a tall guy personality. 3-piece suit, monogrammed shirt, French cuffs. He's been selling real estate since the 70s. Along one whole wall inside Robert's office is whiteboard after whiteboard with the agency's different types of listings. He says his land contract listings are way up.
20, 40, 50, 60 properties, and I have another 50 to put up.
There are just a few listings on the board for traditional mortgage sales.
Most of these boards used to be all traditional.
But then came the housing crash. Tens of thousands of homes in Detroit were seized by the banks. Many of them wound up vacant, and Labute says suddenly his inventory changed.
Because in the 70s, I had a product with a little old lady living in the house that had nicotine all over the place because she smoked like a train. But everything was perfect because we had city inspections. Now these houses are trashed, they're beat up. Over the past 2 years, we've had to take furnaces and water heaters out of any house that becomes vacant. Otherwise, it's gone. There's not a house that has copper in it anymore. That's gone.
And Labute says no bank is going to give you a mortgage to buy a house like this. So
the land contract, I think, is a great medium for people to buy homes. There's some that are not as good as others.
Labute says all his deals disclose things like back taxes. And his buyers get statements, so they know what they're paying toward principal and interest. Not everybody operates this way.
Buyers need to be aware if they're getting into a land contract that they don't sign documents on the back of someone's trunk.
The huge inventory of houses in Detroit has attracted all kinds of investors, from retirees living abroad to big firms with private equity backing. They can't sell the homes on the traditional mortgage market, so they're either looking to unload them for cash or with land contract type deals.
Hello, I'm with the Home Savers campaign, and we're talking to people who bought their homes through Vision Property.
Danae Butler has been canvassing the streets of Detroit for the past couple of days, knocking on the doors of homes owned by Harbor Portfolio Advisors and Vision Property Management. Both those companies scooped up thousands of properties cheap from Fannie Mae, the government-backed mortgage giant. Those firms then sold the homes on land contracts all over the country, including here in Detroit. The Home Savers campaign is trying to educate these would-be homeowners about what their contracts say and then organize them to hopefully leverage better deals for themselves.
Hello. Wait, are you the property owner here?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Danae, and I'm with the Home Savers campaign.
In the front yard of Stavina Dobson's house, four boys are playing football and doing backflips. She got this house 4 years ago from Vision Property Management for $20,000 on a land contract. Property records say Vision got it for just $850. Stavina put in all new plumbing and electrical. She tells Danae Butler she recently called the company to see if she could pay off the contract early.
Been paying.
And they wouldn't let you.
No, for $15,000 more, because only $5,000 went to principal, and I've been paying $376 for the last 5 years.
Stavina says she didn't get statements from Vision, so she didn't realize that most of her land contract installment payments were going to interest and not the principal, so she owed a lot more than she thought. In April, the city of Cincinnati sued both Vision and Harbor Portfolio Management for selling rundown homes to buyers who couldn't keep up with repairs and payments and often defaulted on the high-interest deals. And just a few days after the Home Savers campaign visited Detroit, Fannie Mae announced it would stop selling properties to Vision Property Management. But Fannie Mae isn't the only place where investors can score big bundles of cheap properties. Since 2009, more than 100,000 properties have gone into tax foreclosure in Wayne County. Every September, the county auctions off the properties it seizes. And this is the guy who runs that auction.
How you doing?
You are the man that I've been seeing on television.
Oh, you saw me on TV?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Eric Sabri is the Wayne County treasurer. He says no one used to know who the treasurer was or what he did.
This is Wayne County treasurer Eric Sabri.
Now he gets stopped by strangers who recognize his face from billboards or TV.
Our office is here to help you. Come see us and find out your options. Don't risk losing your home to foreclosure.
The scale of tax foreclosure here in Wayne County is probably 10 times what it is in the next highest county, which I think is Cuyahoga County in Ohio, where Cleveland is. Probably 10 times more.
Sabri says there are three kinds of buyers at the auction. They're the ones he calls amateurs. They might buy one or two houses, but they don't really know what they're doing. There are responsible investors who buy up properties, fix them up, and sell them. He figures maybe half the buyers fit into those two categories.
And the other half are people who kind of do the land contracts or just sit on the properties. They treat them as like commodities, treat the houses like commodities, like they're buying a bushel of wheat or something.
There's no question the tax auction has helped contribute to a spiral of staggering displacement and vacant homes in Detroit. Peter Hammer is a law professor at Wayne State University and directs the Damon Keith Center for Civil Rights there. He says, just look around Detroit. It's hard to describe what happened here as anything less than devastation.
And that devastation creates forms of exploitation that are historic in nature, but are now coming up at levels that we've never seen before.
Hammer says it's important to put Detroit in context here. This is a city that's 80% African American. The median household income is $26,000. Homeownership is considered one of the surefire ways to get ahead. But communities like Detroit, communities of color, have been shut out of that opportunity again and again.
So you now have had centuries of disproportionate access to the housing market, disproportionate access to the ability to acquire and transfer wealth. And so this notion of who can get credit, who cannot get credit to buy a house, has profound long-term consequences on who ultimately has a basic wealth.
Detroit once had one of the highest rates of homeownership in the country. It's now just over 50%, well below the rest of Michigan and the rest of the country. There are some programs working to reverse the decline in homeownership. Credit counseling, home buyer workshops, mortgage assistance. And there are some who say land contracts or lease-to-purchase deals could actually be a good way to help people become homeowners. They say those contracts don't have to be predatory instruments, that if they're written right, they can actually deliver on the promise of homeownership without a mortgage.
Thanks to Sarah Hewlett and our partner, Michigan Radio, for that story. The Urban Institute recently found the foreclosure crisis erased all the gains Black people had made in home ownership since the passage of the Fair Housing Act in the 60s. President Trump has proclaimed June 2017 to be National Home Ownership Month. He says he knows buying a home is out of reach for many young American families. He blamed this on a stagnant economy in the last decade, and he pledged to work with Congress on cutting what he called excessive rules and regulations, which he said make it harder for people to buy homes. Trump acknowledged buying a home is especially hard for people of color. He didn't mention how his financial advisors and rich friends have scooped up tons of housing stock across the country, homes that traditionally young families might have bought. We're going to keep investigating the people in private companies like Colony who found a way to profit off the housing bust. We'll be reporting more stories about why people of color have been disproportionately locked out of home ownership, and we could use your help. If you rent from a big corporate landlord, or if your family has run into trouble buying a home, we want to hear from you. Go to revealnews.org/homeowner to send us your story. We promise to read every response and won't use your information without your permission. Again, that's revealnews.org/homeowner. Laura Starczewski was our lead producer on today's show. Deb George was our senior editor. Reveal's Jennifer LaFleur, Michael Corey, and Rachel DeLeon worked on the Detroit land contract story. We also want to thank researcher Burl Satter, Chicago Reader reporter Maya Dukmasova, and fair housing expert Stella Adams for research help on this hour. WHYY provided production support for today's show. Now, as a Reveal listener, I know you know me, and I know that you love to binge on stories that go deep. Yes, you. I know. I live in your phone. I'm with your podcast all the time. I see it. You want to hear truly important stories told in innovative and compelling ways. Well, my friends, I have got the podcast for you. Northern California public radio station, KQED. Hey, KQED, hey. Just launched a new show that tells those stories by taking listeners on a fascinating and unpredictable journey each week. It's called Cued Up. Whether it's a convict's decade-long journey through the California parole system or how a man attempts to memorize his favorite songs before he goes entirely deaf, Cued Up features some of the finest long-form storytelling in podcast form. Find Cued Up wherever you get your podcasts. That's Q-E-D-U-P. All right, and when you do, tell them Al Edson sent you. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins. My man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. They had help from Catherine Raimondo. Original music and mixing this week by Ramteen Arablouei. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reaver is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.